Hello, everybody. I'm Debbie Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here, and thank you, Walt, for the invitation. I've had a great day so far. I woke up, checked in with God, as I always do, and went for a walk, which, good thinking. I love going for my walks on the weekends. It's about the only time I get to take my walk. And I got home, and my mother, who has been here for 3 weeks, I took her to breakfast. We went to the Queen Mary, saw her off the airport, and did a few other chores, and drove down here to be with you tonight, and I've had a really nice day. I say that just because it's some things that I don't often get to do. This is one of the things that you taught me how to do, is to certainly show up for all my commitments and be present when I'm there. So I've had a really nice day. I hope you have too. There's three things about me that I always like to tell you first, because these are the three most important things in my life. And without these three things in my life in an active state, I don't get to stay comfortable, and for me, after a period of time, I won't be sober. And no, that's not theory, that's not something I read, it's fact for me, because that's been my experience. And those three things, first of all, are a sobriety date. And my sobriety date is February 8th, 1976, which means I've been sober for over 23 years. So that's not my first sobriety date, but it's my last one. And it will stay my last one as long as I continue to do the daily maintenance. It's not about what I did last week or even yesterday or 10 years ago. It's about the maintenance I do today. And I told you a couple of the things that I do, and I did a lot more of those things that to you would be insignificant perhaps, but to me, it's some of the things that I've made commitments to do. And the first and foremost thing is that physical sobriety for me. And I believe in complete physical sobriety. That means that I don't drink near beer. I don't smoke near pot. I don't drop near acid. I don't do any near stuff, you know. And why would we want to fool around with the imitation when we know what the real stuff does, you know, and just sit there and pretend? And I'm very, very possessive and protective of my physical sobriety. I don't play games with it, and I don't put it in jeopardy, and I don't, I don't care what y'all do, but I choose not to have any alcohol or social drugs for potential visitors. I know everybody who's coming over there, you know, because I know me. If it's there, I'm going to have it, and I know me that one day I'm just going to just have one of those wild thoughts and decide to come visit myself, you know. So I don't care what y'all do, but that's what I have to do, because every time it's been in front of me, I do it or take it or whatever I do with it. And I just protect my physical sobriety to the best of my ability. And that is the first and foremost thing. But I also know that is, for me, it is the beginning. It always has to be that constant. But that's not the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous is about to me. That has to be in place in order for anything else to happen in my life. The steps, the traditions, the principles of this program, in order for them to work, they have to have a physical plane and a physical, sober physical plateau to work on. And so that is only the beginning, but it's far from the end for me. And the reason I know that is because I would get asked questions by people we know as social drinkers. They would ask me questions like, why do you always have to get drunk? Why can't you just have a couple like we do? And I didn't know that I was answering them in the most honest answer there was, without any information about this disease of alcoholism. My response was, I don't know. I didn't know anything about this disease. I didn't know why I'm either drunk or undrunk. There's no happy hour phase in there, okay? So those are that's where I am. And I didn't know why I could just, as they said, have a couple, because it never occurred to me to just have a couple. I was never interested in having a couple. I always knew I wanted to get drunk. So I didn't understand that, and I told them I don't know. And so I was put in an institution, and I didn't have alcohol and drugs available to me. And so I had the impression that then with this absence of everything, then your life gets wonderful. And I ended up drinking after a period of several months because I hadn't been drinking. And people like you understand what that is. Because I don't know, and I'm not taking any steps. I'm not interested in this thing they call sobriety, which includes not drinking. I'm not interested in that. I know I'm going to drink again. I just don't know what the when or where of it. But I don't know what to do with the stuff on the inside. And so that's where I know that physical sobriety alone, and no steps, no meetings, no anything else, will not sustain me for very long. And I certainly won't be comfortable for any period of time without the other things involved. And so that physical sobriety, that's got to be in place. And if you are new here tonight and you don't have a sobriety date, I really encourage you to get one, because Alcoholics Anonymous will make a lot more sense when you're sober. So let's start there, okay? The second and third thing are very important to me too, and that is the home group. I've been a member of the Bellflower Big Book Group for 13 years since I've lived in California. Prior to that, I was a member of the Skyland Group in Atlanta, Georgia for almost 7 years, and my first home group was the 12 and 12 group in Minneapolis for almost 4. And I believe very strongly in a home group. It has been in this kind of an environment that I have learned how to live out there where regular kind of people walk around. And I don't know how to fit in there. I got to you when I was 18 years old, and I didn't know anything about life. I didn't know manners. I didn't know etiquette. I didn't know how to be a lady, which these were the things that would develop that would be important to me. I didn't know how to socialize. I didn't know how to do anything but drink. And that skill won't get you that far in life. And so I watched you, and I learned from you, and being in meetings, many, many things. Well, everything that I know how to do out there that's good and decent, I learned from you in here. And one of the very first things you taught me was courtesy and consideration. You see, I didn't know the first thing about that. It was all about me. I was very self-absorbed and self-centered and self-involved, and it was always about me. It was about making an entrance or being seen or being noticed or whatever. And you told me, just be quiet and sit down, because you know what? You might not be interested in your sobriety, but perhaps the people around you are. And I'm so glad I learned that early, because I would have missed many of those one-liner statements that have changed my life had I been dancing around the room. And so you taught me about consideration and courtesy for other people. And not just here in meetings where we all can look good, but out on that marketplace or that freeway or wherever we are, to take those elsewhere. You taught me about commitments. And I was terrified of having a commitment. That was responsibility. And you don't know it, but I'm not responsible. I'm not trustworthy. I may not be here next week. I don't even know. And don't give me anything to do that requires reliability. And you said, we just do this a meeting at a time. Well, some of the pressure came off, and I figured I could probably do it a meeting at a time. And I know that a meeting won't fold if I don't show up, but it makes it important for me to show up. It makes it, because I'm a taker, and this is one of the ways that I can be of service and give and not get that recognition or be the center of attention, just learning how to be one among many amongst you. And I've served all of my groups in a variety of ways. I don't care what I do. Every year I do the same thing. I ask the secretary, what do you want me to do? I've not asked for a job. I just figure it's between them and God what new things I'm going to learn this year. And I believe in rotation. And so some of the commitments I hate to give up, but, you know, it is important to learn some new things and allow other people to do what I just finished doing. And you know, one of the commitments I hated giving up was the last one I just did. And that commitment was to bring the toilet paper every Monday night. And I love that commitment, you know. It's an early commitment. You have to get there early. It's very thankless. You know, nobody says, hey, who brought the two-ply? You know, thank you. Appreciate it. No, they don't do that. And it's real anonymous. It's anonymous unless you don't bring it. Then they will find you. You know, it's kind of like the coffee maker. Everybody expects it to be there unless it's not. And uh, But you know, it was such a fun commitment, but I know that a woman I sponsor has that commitment this year, so I know it's covered. I know that. In fact, I'm covering it this Monday night, in fact, when she's gone. So, you know, but it's those kinds of things that just, you know, nobody knows about that you're doing it, but you do it, and it just makes you feel good. And I didn't know about doing something for free and for fun like that. How to be a part of. Because I like credit. I like credit for 6 months on one good deed. You know, that's the kind of credit I like. You taught me here how to be a better daughter, which applied today because my mother has visited me for 3 weeks. That's a long time. You know? That's a long time. And you taught me how to be a good host and how to listen and how not to change that person, whoever they may be. You taught me how to be a good guest when it's reversed. And, you know, this was one of the ways for me to make some of those amends. Now, when I took my first drink at 12 years old, I cut my family out of my life emotionally. I no longer wanted them. I no longer needed them. I didn't know how to financially support myself, so I stayed. But that was the only thing I needed them for. Because I don't know what happened, but the wall came down regarding them. I get sober when I'm 18. I take these steps. I make those amends. But basically, for the next several years, you know, I would call them a couple times a year, kind of, I guess, let them know I'm still alive and about. And after I was about 14 years sober, and I got to thinking, I think that it would be important, a good idea, to improve or do something regarding this relationship with my family. You know, I am their only child, and, you know, I'm it. So I listened to how you repaired your relationship. And so I did something that I knew I could do, because one of the things I've learned from you is do what you say you're going to do. And I have to get my ego out of the way a lot of times, because my life is very full, and I have a very full plate all the time. And so I have to make sure that whatever it is I'm saying, I can back it up. Because my word to me, you've taught me about doing what I say I'm going to do, is very, very important. It may not mean beans to you, but to be responsible for what I say I'm going to do or whatever is very important to me. And I told them in January of 1991, I'm going to call you the first Sunday of every month, and that was today. And so I made my call today. There's 6 people on that list, and I have not missed the first Sunday in, well, 8 years and 12 months, whatever it would be. And you taught me about that. They expect that call. They look forward to that call, and I'm responsible about that call. No matter where I am in the country, they get that call the first Sunday of the month. And having my mother down here for 3 weeks was at her request. And, you know, you think, what are you going to do for 3 weeks? You know, wouldn't one probably good enough? But, you know, you say, sure, come on down. Love to have you for 3 weeks. But, you know, it's, you show me this is my way of being able to make some of those amends for all those years that I was distant. And you showed me how to be a better daughter. You showed me here how to be a better employee. I've been with my current company for 7.5 years, and I have a very good relationship with them and all the people that I have worked for in the past. And you explained, you know, that y'all want me to be self-supporting and through my own contributions and to probably go to work and things like that, and I didn't have a problem with that. But you wanted me to go every day. Now that was funny. No, you know, I'm not available every day. I'm not up to it every day. And they said, well, when you're sober, you will be, you know. And they were right. I have been sober, and I go to work every day, and I'm a part of it. And he also taught me how to take Tradition One into that workplace and how to place the unity of this company really comes before my little whims and whines. He taught me how to take that attitude of how can I be of service into the workplace. And it just makes a relationship with everyone in there so much easier. And so I know about that, and you've shown me how to be a better employee. You showed me how to be a friend. And I'll tell you, sometimes that gets challenged to me in the sense of I have to ask myself, is my friendship conditional? Is it based on whether or not I approve of what you're doing? Is my self-righteousness coming out? You know, you taught me how to be there for people for free and for fun, even when I don't understand, even when it might disappoint or hurt my feelings. You know what? I'm not God's appointed assistant in their life. I'm here to be of service. And if you know, their plans are different than mine, that's all right. And it takes me a lot sometimes to get to that point. But you tell me about being a friend, about being there for free and for fun, and I only know how to use you. When I need something or want something, I when I'm done with that, then I go on about my business again. And it's about using you, and you taught me about how to be near for people and not keep score. That was a very, very big thing, how to not keep score, because I'm a scorekeeper. I know that you don't know what the rules are, but I do, and I'm the scorekeeper. And I keep track of how many wonderful, kind, and loving things I do for you. And then I also keep track about what things you do not do for me, you know. And I always have more points than you do. And so I get this very negative feeling of superiority, and that my self-righteousness comes out, and you said, get rid of that thing. And I'll tell you, it was difficult, and I was reluctant, and yet, as many things, the minute I let go and surrender to it, what a tremendous freedom I get. I don't have to remember any kind gesture to you, because that's how I'm supposed to be living anyway. And I certainly don't have to remember the perceived, usually ill-perceived, negative things that may have come to me, because that stuff just gets ugly. And I don't want to have to be thinking and remembering about that. And so you've taught me about how to be a friend. You showed me in here about getting married in Alcoholics Anonymous and live happily ever after. And then you showed me how to get unmarried in Alcoholics Anonymous and live happily ever after. Basically, you showed me how you do life. How you do life sober. Oh, here we go. All right. My competition. You showed me how to live life sober. And when it was a little tough, you showed me how you do it with some dignity and grace. And I don't know how you do it like that. I know how you do it like a 3-year-old. I know how you do it like, you know, some brat, spoiled brat. But I don't know how you do it like grown up. But because I've watched you go through really big, tough deals with some dignity and grace, I'll tell you, I've drawn from your strength on how you do that. And so that's what a home group, just a couple of the things that a home group has given me. And the third thing is a sponsor. At 23 years of sobriety, I wouldn't even think about being without a sponsor. And I've had 3 sponsors in sobriety because I've lived in 3 different states. And all of my sponsors have had a number of qualities. They've had more sobriety than me, which is what I was looking for, especially when I was new, because I needed, that lent you credibility to me. I would believe what you said if you had significantly more time than me. But they've all been active members in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the front lines of AA. They haven't been somebody who goes to a meeting every 6 months, you know, because they think they should. And the other thing is that these are people that I want to be like when I grow up, because they wear Alcoholics Anonymous so beautifully that they're people that I saw that were standing still in their own skin, and I didn't know how you did that. The people who I saw had some sort of a grounding about them, a peace on the inside, and I came to understand that was the development of the relationship with the God of their understanding. And the other thing is they had a life in their eyes. They have life in their eyes, and I knew even I was coming in here with dead eyes. And I saw this life in their eyes, and it was an attraction. And I've been with these people in all social, personal situations, meetings, and one-on-one, and I've been in with them and all, and they practice and live this as a way of life in all of their affairs. They're not different in this setting versus that setting. They behave this way in all of their affairs. And that's what I needed and wanted to learn how to do and how they taught me. And it was sort of like, I don't know what y'all do, but I'm going to follow you and hang out with you and watch what you do and be around you because I want to live that way too. Because the first time I was introduced to you and I heard, you know, if you want what we have, I would look at the material things, the physical, the pretty things, the cars, the guys, the whatever. Yeah, I want some of that too. But you see, this third time when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was oblivious to that type of thing because that was no longer what caught my eye. What caught my eye was with the peace within you because I did not have that. And I knew it. And I knew that that's what I wanted. So if you are new here tonight and you don't have one or all three of these things in your life in an active state, a sobriety date that's honest, a home group that you're an active member in and not some wallflower that nobody knows, get in the middle of this thing, and a sponsor that you're actively working with, if you don't have them, I really encourage you to get them and activate them. Because if you don't like the way you're living and feeling anymore, you don't have to live that way anymore. Because if you are an alcoholic, we have a solution for you here. You see, in 23 years, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place that I have been. I haven't so far had a problem that has taken me to any other outside source. So far to this moment, all the problems I've had, the solutions have been in the steps, the traditions, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, sharing with others, working with a sponsor. Our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me a tremendous amount of things and continues to. I don't know how they end up rewriting that book all the time, you know, and I love it. After 23 years, I still see things that just strike me. And that's the only tools I've used. And I'm really glad because I'm somebody who can just complicate anything. I can complicate a paperclip, okay? You know, I'm just grateful I can keep it really simple. And this is all I do is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that it works for 23 years with those three things in place because prior to that I didn't have those in place and I didn't and couldn't stay sober. I've had those in place and I have, and so the math is very simple for me, what does and does not work. And so those three things are the most important thing in my life. And if you don't have those things, I really encourage you to get them. Because this is a heck of a journey that we're all on. The one that I've been on has been tremendous. It doesn't mean that it hasn't been full of life. Life on life's terms. But you know what? There hasn't been one single day, regardless of the kind of day it appeared to be, that I have not said goodnight to the God of my understanding and thanked Him for a good day. Because I ended up sober. I ended up sober. I did not take a drink today. That is a good day. And my journey to Alcoholics Anonymous began in April of 1970. It was a Friday the 13th. I have loved Fridays ever since. They are my favorite day of the week. And Friday the 13th was a good day for me. I was 12 years old when I took that first drink that night, and that makes me 42, so we get all those numbers out of the way for you. I know y'all counting in there. Just wrap that up. And I woke up that morning and I had a, you know, you can't count very fast that way, you know. That's how I feel. I woke up that Friday morning. And I knew I was going to get drunk that night. Now, I'd never been drunk. I don't know how you get drunk. I just kind of figured you probably have to drink a whole bunch. I don't know. I've never seen anyone drunk before. I didn't know I was going to be the first person I saw drunk. But that would be the case. And that night, I had been invited early in the week by the cool kids in school to this party. And wild horses were not going to keep me away from that. And I couldn't wait to go because this was the group of kids I wanted to be hanging out with. I didn't fit in the other groups. I didn't fit with the academically inspired or the athletes. These were the people who drank and smoked cigarettes, and they looked like they were having some fun, and that's where I wanted to go. And so I went to this party that night, and I do remember it as if it just happened a couple of days ago. I arrived at that party at 6 o'clock that night, and I had no idea that night would literally change the course of my life. Had no idea, because we began to drink that night, and I don't know what the first thing was that I swallowed, but he was in a brown bag, and it was coming to me, and I watched what they did, so I imitated them. I took a pull off of that bottle, and I gave it to the next guy. Not for one second did I inquire what that was. Not for a second did I think about the way my parents had drank. I did see them drink now and then. Nothing regular. It was usually when they had guests over, and that was maybe one or two drinks all night long, and they'd put in ice and mix and stuff in it, you know. I've never to this day seen them take a bottle of anything and put it to their mouth and take a pull off it, and that's how I took my first and most of the drinking I would do. And it was going down, it was burning my throat, and I did not find that objectionable. This was a good omen. This is a good sign. It's burning my throat. And as it's going down, it hits what we call that bottom, and to me it was like hot lava. It was warm, and it was thick, and it flowed, and it filled every hole in my gut that it found, and I didn't even know I had any. I took that first drink because I wanted to be accepted by those kids. I didn't take that first drink because I was running away from a horrible home life. I was born and raised in South Dakota and then North Dakota, and I had kind and loving parents. I'd never seen abuse or violence or an argument in front of me to this moment. I wasn't running away because the lights are always turned off and there's never food. I've never heard about problem drinking. There is no identified alcoholism on either side of my family. If there is alcoholism, these people are dead, buried, nobody's talking, you know, because I am the token representative here in AA. I've looked, I've inquired, nobody's mum's the word, I guess, I don't know. But I took that drink, and it just filled in those holes, and I didn't know I had any. And I had just the slightest bit of relaxation on the inside of me. And I've got this warm glow 2 inches behind my belly button, and I'm thinking, you know what, I'm 12 years old, and oatmeal has never done this for me, you know. I don't know what's in that stuff, but I want some more. And when it got back to me, I did exactly the same thing I did the first time. I took a pull off that bottle. I gave it to the next guy. It burned my throat. It didn't bother me a bit. Went down, did that magic. And between here and here, that anxiety turned into arrogance. That anxiety of wanting to be so much a part of those people and please accept me turned into sort of throwing back my shoulders. Then I started to look around the room. And I just thought to myself, hey, aren't they glad I'm here, you know? That's drink number two. And you know what? If there is some invisible line, it got crossed right then and there between one and two. I didn't know that I was experiencing a top symptom, and that is in the doctor's opinion. It perfectly describes me. That men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Very specifically alcohol. It doesn't say produced by ice cream or shopping or moving. It says alcohol. And I had no idea, and there would be no way for me to have any vision, that when all these other little kids take a drink, normal things happen. But when I take a drink, abnormal things happen. There's no way for me to know that. And I didn't know anything about this effect. All I knew was that I liked how I felt, and it changed, and I went from desperately needing your approval to who needs you in 1 to 2 drinks. And I liked this new state, and it would be as if I went through a set of doors and into another room, and I never did, nor have I returned to the room that I once occupied. Because the age of innocence when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous was long gone. And I took that second drink, and that change happened to me. And I didn't know it, but that night I would set off a frequent pattern. It didn't happen every single night or every time I drank, but most of the time I blacked out. Often I would pass out, and occasionally I would come to with my dry heaves, and that night all three of those happened for the very first time. Because you see, what I would do on a consistent basis was I would drink as much as I could, as fast as I could, whatever I could. Slowing down, controlling it, taking it out easy through the night, never ever occurred to me. I knew one thing that night when I had been drugged home from the party, and I've got this first case of the dry heaves, which I do not know what they are. What I just described to you, those three things, I did not know what the names of those were until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But it appeared that I couldn't quite remember everything that happened. There was some time missing, and I apparently took a nap that night. And this retching must be, I must have eaten something disagreeable this morning, you know. And I know all of these things I have not had happen before. And I also know that prior to tonight, that I have not taken a drink and gotten drunk before. But I know this as clear as I'm standing here. But drinking has nothing to do with this. Nothing. This is not a penalty. This is not a price. I don't know what it is, but it's not a problem. And I did not know from the very beginning I am protecting my right and my interest to drink. I didn't know that. And my, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, and that's exactly how much time I spend thinking about it. I could care less. But I do know that I activated an alcoholic that night. I took that first drink and I activated the mental obsession. Because you see, that morning it still had been important to me to be a good daughter and a good student and obey the rules and stay out of trouble. I don't like trouble. I don't like negative attention. But from this point on, you would not know that because it just seemed to follow me. And I activated that mental obsession because when I woke up Saturday morning and for the next 6 years, my awakening thoughts were about drinking. And all these good intentions eventually just were removed from the list because I can't do them anyway. And I activated the physical craving. I didn't know anything about moderation or having a couple. I've never been interested in a couple. I'm either drunk or undrunk. I didn't know it was the first drink that set up the cycle. I never tried to control my drinking. Why? You know, I didn't drink with people who didn't drink the way I did, and you found them out the very first night. And so I never thought about it because, you see, my experiences that night were my first and only experiences, so they were automatically my assumption of what happens to everybody. But until I came to you, did I find out that it didn't. I didn't know that. My drinking was limited to basically weekends, and at every additional opportunity I could create, I'm 13 years old, a year later, and I'm introduced to the wonderful world of drugs. And I needed to be introduced to them. I needed assistance. You know, I drink whiskey out of a bottle with a beer chaser, and I'm not interested in drinks with fruit and umbrellas and fruit, you know, and all this crap in them. I just happen to like whiskey, and I want to get there now, not Wednesday, you know, with all this frou-frou, and so I, this is just what happened, my interest went to is whiskey and with a beer chaser, but I tend to black out too quickly. And I, the more I'm sober, the longer I'm sober, the more I seem to hear either people who were really enjoying downers and they wanted to just kind of forget about life and just let it sail on by and just be numb to it, or the kind that I was attracted to. These are the people who didn't want to miss out on anything, and you found your little helpers in speed and acid. And that became my newfound pals, and they're the kind of things that help you get there quickly and colorfully, you know. And that's what I love doing. I love being up for days on end, you know, just drinking and doing these drugs. And you looked like death warmed over, but you didn't miss anything, you know. That was important. You were everywhere, you know. Oh, my God. And that was the group that I was running with, you know. That was how I went on in my last year and a half of active drinking, was on a daily basis. And my diet was whiskey and acid, and that's what I did. And at 17 and a half years old, I have now been expelled from my senior year of high school 6 weeks before graduation. And this is the third and final time as far as they're concerned. And all three times had been because of my drinking problem. You know, 24 years ago, nice girls don't get thrown out of their high school because of their drinking problems, and yet I did. In fact, last night I was, normal people, regular non-alcoholic people sometimes do not know how to take us. And I love throwing them off the path like that. You know how we get, the little devil gets in us, I think, sometimes. And so last night I'm co-emceeing this Belmont for a Christmas parade, and I did this last year with this guy, and he is just really fun and jovial, and he'll throw questions out at me, and he said to me, we've got these little cheerleaders are going by, this little cheerleading drill team squad and stuff. He said to me, Debbie, have you ever been a cheerleader? And I said, no, I used to be a pom-pom girl, though, and I was the halftime entertainment. And he looked at me aghast, and then he went into hysterical laughing. He did not know I really was the entertainment. We would go out, and this was in my senior year of high school. I mean, talk about a Jekyll and Hyde, talk about a juxtaposition of people. During the day, I loved that pom-pom girl practice and just dance, dance, dance. And then we would do a show. We would do the halftime entertainment. And I would be ripped to the gills between drugs and drinking. And all of them knew it, except apparently the coach. And the girls would always say to me the night of the game, please, please wait until after the show. Okay? Okay. And I knew I wouldn't. And so I'd show up just ripped. And yet I would be the only one who knew the routine, you know, how we just kind of get through these things. I'm just singing and dancing away. I run off the field, but of course I keep running. I forget to stop. You know, those are the kinds of things I would do. And I remember very vividly the coach, we're all gathered around, says, you know, when you go out there, you need to smile. I mean, you look like you're having a good time. I look out there, and Debbie is the only one smiling. And they're all like, yeah, but do you know why? You know, kind of a thing. You know, so we take it and say, but, you know, here I am, this little pom-pom girl. I'm working for the city judge. And then after 5 o'clock, I am in another world. You know, I just had such separate lives. It's like the lights went down in life and I am someone else. And I understand that change in personality very well. And so I'm now expelled from my senior year of high school, and because I forget that I am in high school, and I forget to show up, and I take vacations that nobody knows about. I extended week-long vacations, and I show up wondering, what's the big deal? You know how we do. And finally, my father had had enough. I mean, I have tortured this man's heart and his emotions and his mental state beyond their capacity. And he sought professional advice. He did not know what to do with me. And that professional said, well, you still have legal custody. You need to commit her. And that's what he did. I showed up 2 weeks later for money, and that's what he did. And on a Friday of May of 1975, I was committed to a hospital at the age of 17 and a half years old for alcoholism and drug addiction. A little town in Grand Forks, North Dakota, in this little hospital. And I'm 17, and the next age to me is 35, and I definitely know I'm way too young to be an alcoholic. I mean, I can't even legally buy it. How could I possibly be an alcoholic? And I will be introduced to you and hear the words Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety and the disease of alcoholism for the very first time. I've never heard those words before. And it didn't take long to realize why. Y'all don't drink. I'm not interested. I don't think so. You know, I'm not interested in not drinking. Why would I seek you out? You know, I don't have a problem. I just like to have fun. And that was my attitude. I would be taken outside meetings like the rest of the gang in there, and I'd sit in the back of the room and distract myself because, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have to sit up front and listen. And I would hear you say things that I have to rationalize why my case is different. But the problem was is that where I really live, that 2 inches behind my belly button, I'm starting in my own way to identify. And I don't want to identify. If I do, I might be one of you. And I would hear you say things like, I lost my family because of drinking. And I would think to myself up here, do you know how lucky you are? I want to lose my family. God, what a source of irritation. Because they're always on my drinking. And yet down here where I really live that nobody knows, I knew it had been necessary for me to leave their home because they no longer had a safe place to come home to. They never knew what they were coming home to. And you talked about totaling out cars. I have never totaled out a car officially, okay? Now, I have a little drunk car that arrived here. We all have those kind of things. You buy them, they start off square, and then they get kind of rounded out to drunk bumps, and things are missing, and the window had been shot out of it, and my gas cap in the end was a mitten stuck in there, you know? I'm telling you, it just terrifies me when I think about this mitten in there, but if that is, that's a true story. You can't make that one up. But I'd never officially totaled out a car. That was my, difference. They talked about drunk driving charges, and I was the designated drunken driver of my group. And I worked for the city judge, as I mentioned earlier, and so when the police would stop me, I knew them, they knew me, they took away our booth, and they told us to go home. So we didn't have any drunk driving charges. And I heard you talk about jails and prisons and institutions you had been in, and my God, you know, I mean, I'm ignorant of the fact that I'm in an institution listening to this stuff, but kind of like that doesn't count. And I would only focus on the people who'd been in prison, those really serious criminal kind of people, and I think, see, that doesn't apply, because I have only been in jail 3 times, and it was always a misunderstanding, you know. It doesn't count, so, in case you're wondering. I heard you talk about losing jobs, and that last year I always worked for the judge, but I always tried to have a little something else because I needed the money, and I would forget I had these jobs, and I wouldn't show up, and I was fired from a few and asked to quit from a few, but that last year especially, I got this bad habit, and I would quit in blackouts. Well, this is awkward when you go to work the next day, you know. Everybody is surprised, you know, including you, you know. And you didn't know you quit, and they didn't know you were in a blackout. So those are awkward, very awkward moments. And then there was a couple of things you talked about that really bothered me. And you talked about all of those broken promises. And from the time I was 12, I knew I had not been able to keep a promise, because always at the end of that promise was, and be good. And in our language, that meant don't drink or take any drugs. And I would mean it, and I would want to do that, because I'm tired of seeing the look on your face, the hurt, the disappointment, the disgust of what am I going to do with yous, all of those kinds of things that always accompanied every continuous mistake and goof up I would do. And I would mean it, but I'll tell you, I don't know of anything about alcoholism. I do not know that I am an alcoholic. I do not know that I am powerless over alcohol. All I know is when that second Friday rolled around, I am so uncomfortable. I feel like I got nerve endings standing out. I feel like my hair is sticking up, and I feel like I got this ball of fire in my gut. And I don't know what to do about it, because nothing anybody's doing or saying or nothing I'm doing or saying is making it go away, except I know one thing that makes me feel better. And that's a drink. I know what that'll do. I know that makes me feel better. But I've made this promise, and that second Friday starts getting real narrow, and it comes down to a decision about either feeling good or being good. And when I get to this point, there isn't a decision. Because being good is just going to have to happen another time. That's all I can tell you, because I need to feel good now. Nobody's telling in my ear, this too shall pass. Huh, I don't think so. I need to feel good now, and the minute I make that decision about feeling good, I'll tell you what, all this pressure that just feels like it's just closing in just starts lightening up. It just starts to like vanish in a mist or something, and I'm on my way to go drink. And by the time I get to where I'm going, I don't have any memory of what I promised, what I was supposed to do, where I was supposed to be, what I said. All I know is I'm going to feel good pretty soon. Let the party begin. I mean, I'm already off in that other world. And I don't know anything about being powerless over alcohol, but that calls and I respond, because I have no power against it. I have no mental defense against the first drink. And the other thing was, there was a woman who talked about trying to scrub away the smell. I had this funny odor, and I don't know what it is. And I've tried to puff and powder and perfume it away, and it won't go away. And she said that was booze coming through her pores. And the thing that gave me those pills was that I knew that she knew what the smell smelled like. And she said she was an alcoholic and she doesn't drink anymore. And I just kept thinking, can we just get around this not drinking thing? You know, if we can just kind of work it around that, it'd be more appealing to me. But there isn't any sort of social drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. No, abstinence is a requirement for me. And I just thought, you know what, if I'm not careful, I might be one of those people. I was sent to an all-women's halfway house, and I'd be there 7 months, and then I went on vacation to visit my mother in Northern California. And I was there 2.5 weeks. First week, I hung around with people I used to drink with. Last week and a half, I was drunk and loaded. No surprise. And I think this is another reason why I let her come down to stay as long as she wants to, because this is part of my amends of trying to be a better daughter, because I was not a very good daughter then. And I got my definition for me of it quit working, because you see, it always had worked. It had always worked. It always quieted my mind, and now no matter how much I put in me, it does not do that. And my mind, I can be physically drunk up to here, but my mind will not get numb, will not get quiet, it will not shut up. And that is what I think about Reader's Digest version of when it quit working for me. I'm very aware when that happened. I came back to Minneapolis. I set my meetings up from 1 a month to 1 a week. Sounded like a lot of meetings to me. 5 weeks later, I get a letter in the mail with one joint from a friend in California, and I decided to keep it because it's like, you know, you never know when you might need it. You know? And it was just amazing. I needed it the next day. You know? What timing, right? Yeah, right. That is the experience I think about why I choose not to keep anything in my house, because it was there and I took it and I didn't think about anything else but that. I smoked that one joint on that Saturday, February 7, 1976. And it was a conflict, it was a debate. And when I was finally finished, you see, one of the things that I know about is that I wasn't going to tell anybody. That's why I didn't go out any rip-roaring bins. Boy, if I'm going to get loaded, I might as well do it up good. You see, it was just going to be one more lie. It was just going to be one more sleep-in-the-night action. One more cowardly action. Oh, that's why I didn't tell anybody. That's why I didn't have a rip-roaring time out there. But you see, it did exactly for me what I had not been able to do and nobody else. He kicked me off the fence of reservation and indecision whether or not I was an alcoholic and had this disease. And that night I knew I had surrendered, because surrender I have seen in my life a number of times, a couple of real big times, and that is that it's almost like a level playing field now. The dust is settled. There's no more debate. There's no more argument. There's no more what ifs or anything. It's almost like an indifference. It's just flat. And I know I am done running the show. And I believe that night God stepped in and he had removed all the objections I had always been able to create, why my case is different, and put in there, but you know what? I don't want to keep living the way I'm living, because it has no direction and no purpose and no use at all. But the people in AA seem to know what to do. And you see, I hadn't thought of them about that like that before at all. And I had always found the differences, why I'm different. But this night it was different. I found that those people can help me. And I went to those people the next day, the 8th of February, and that's my sobriety date. And I said, what do you do to stay sober? And they knew I meant business. They know I wasn't coming from a little smart aleck kind of place anymore. Cute questions, cute answers, a little chip on my shoulder. Don't need to do all you do. They knew I meant business. And you see, a lot of people have asked me, wasn't it hard to get sober young? You know what? This might sound like a stupid answer, but I don't know. Because you see, when I meant business, your age and mine was irrelevant. I didn't notice it. My background and yours was irrelevant. I didn't notice it. I didn't notice whether your hair was dark or gray. I just knew you were living a whole lot better than I was. And I was sick of running my life. Because that's what you said I was doing. I didn't know that. And so I don't know if it's hard getting young sober because I quit finding the differences and started looking at the similarities. So I don't know if it's hard. I asked them and they told me what they did. They said, one day at a time. We don't take the first drink or anything else that affects us from the neck up. Well, regular meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, and get a home group. We get a sponsor. We take these steps and we get a God of our understanding. We practice the principles we've learned from taking these steps in all of our affairs. We try to apply the traditions on a personal basis. Try to carry this message to others and be of service. And I haven't found it necessary to add anything to that. See, I came back here. It wasn't the physical that defeated me. It was the mental and the spiritual and the emotional bankruptcy that I felt that brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I made a commitment here to you and to this way of life one day at a time. And I started on this journey, and for my first 4 years, I was in a meeting every single night or service commitment. It was work in AA, and I was full, and I had a great life and was active. And I was a couple weeks down my fourth birthday. I moved to Atlanta, got that sponsor locked in, got that home group locked in, the styling group met twice a week, turned four, and I decided somewhere in there, I know something now. I'm 4 years sober. That's the first dangerous thing, you know, is that you think you know something. And what happened is I decided, you know what, I've been going to 7 meetings a week. I think I'm going to cut back a little bit and acclimate myself a little bit to Atlanta because things are different here. And they really don't care where I came from, however they did it back there. So don't offer your unsolicited advice. And so I think I'll just kind of slowly get acclimated. And I'm going to go to 2 or 3 meetings a week. I went from 7 to 2 meetings a week. That's quite drastic. Not that I had big plans for those other 5 nights of the week. But we go down to 2 meetings a week, and when I get that kind of thinking in my head, sort of a constriction, I start shaving that down too. And I'm 6 years sober 2 years later, and I've got a real familiar feeling. I feel like I got nerve endings standing out, and I feel like my hair is sticking straight up, and I feel like a big ball of fire is in my gut. I'm 6 years sober. I'm 24 years old. I'm thinking, is this all there is? My attitude isn't too cool. My attitude has not been one of loving, kind, giving, caring for you. It's back to what's in it for me. It's back about take, 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 and I don't really know that. But I had to start looking at the things I stopped doing. You see, I've been trained to get to my meetings early, especially my home group meeting. And I get there an hour before it starts. I did then and I do now. And yet from 4 to 6 years of sobriety, that hour got shorter and shorter. And I know I can't come in late. Because I think if you're not here from the opening prayer to the closing prayer, you've missed out on something, for sure. And I know I can't come in late, but I'm getting it 5 minutes before the meeting, locking the book up into account. Because I don't want to disrupt the start of the meeting. But I haven't said hello to anybody. I haven't shaken hands. I haven't welcomed newcomers. I haven't given out. I haven't asked, how's your day been? And the same with leaving. You know, I know I can't leave early, but we go from being one of the last people to leave to we go, amen, shake, shake, and you're looking at my taillights. I'm out of there. And I'm wondering, you know, I've got this attitude, I got that done. I'm wondering why I'm so unfulfilled. It's because I've gone to take, take, and not do any giving. And I didn't know that. But I'm 6 years sober, I take that birthday cake. 3 weeks later, I thought I found the solution to why I was so restless, irritable, and discontent. And I met him. And I met this little fella on this poor thing. He did not know what hit him. It was a Friday night, and I looked at that as an omen, you know. And he had a lot of good qualifications. In fact, he'd been sober 13 years, and he hadn't been to a meeting in 3 years. But hey, no problem, I'm going to hip him. So I thought, to hip this little fellow, whether he wanted my hip or not, he was going to get it, because I know how to persevere, and I know how to try and change your mind the way I think you should. And I'm in charge of running the universe now as far as I'm concerned, and I'm going to coordinate it and manipulate it to how I want it to be. And I'll tell you, it's a very empty job. It's difficult. It's a lot of work, especially when they're not cooperating with you. And, you know, it was as if the light switch of insanity got flipped on inside of me. I don't know what I looked like on the outside. You know, I think pretty okay exterior, but the inside was like the picture of Dorian Gray. It was getting more crazier and insane and uglier as we go. And after 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved, I hate those times, you know? God! But I get to do it a few more times, don't worry. God, he was amused, and so he got my attention. This little fellow went off and married somebody else. So I let him go. And, you taught me how to be a good sport here, so, okay. So I just sort of sat around, looked around the room, and bingo, there was another little fellow very similar in qualification, and we did this dance to death for 3 months, and I watched him go down the aisle with somebody else, too. And so I'll tell you, mercifully, God had had enough of my amusement, and it was just this major meltdown. That's all I can think about it as it was, this major meltdown, because I could no longer keep running my own life again. And I didn't know that's what I was doing until it all was pulled out. And I know that I am an alcoholic is what this point came to. I am at the fork in the road. And I either need to get relief. There's only two avenues. Either drink again and I've proven to me satisfactorily it no longer works, or recommit myself to Alcoholics Anonymous 110%. Not 100, but 110. You see, it's always, I know what to do. It's the and then some, that extra 10% that makes the difference in my life every day. Driving 2 hours to come and share with you is a little bit of the and then some, okay? You know? And yet, I know that this, I will walk away from here. I don't know how you will feel, but I know how I'm going to walk away from here. A lot better. And fulfilled and feeling good. And know that I had done what I was asked to do. And I know what that and then some is, and that's the part that changes my life on a daily basis. Again, it's not what I did yesterday, it's the and then some for today, the daily maintenance. And so I made that commitment, and I took these steps again with my sponsor at that time as if I had never taken them before. It was a brand new journey again. And I'm 6 years and 9 months sober, and I did another four-step inventory, and this one just really had three things on it, a stepmother, father, and men. You know, just put them all together. And I took a look at 6 and 7, and it totally, they came alive for me. 6 and 7 basically said to me, or I said to them, I no longer want to act like the boy. This is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I don't want to be like the kid anymore. I want to be like the big people. It's time, and I want to grow up. And that's what 6 and 7 said to me. And 7 gives me an opportunity to practice some of the positive opposites of my defects, the ones I know about, the ones I'm aware about. And I made amends and made that list, and I made some better amends. And the last one to my stepmother from that original list was finally cleaned up and clear. And I was free, and I knew it. And I began this journey, and I'm more active and busy and sharing and working with women and more meetings, and I'm 8.5 years sober, and I'm just feeling this little twinge of being restless, irritable, and discontent, and thinking, you know, why can't it just always stay out there, full out, you know? And Guy, because I'm a regular in my meetings and I'm in there to listen, told me the answer. He's talking about being sober a number of years, and he talked about feeling this way, restless, irritable, and discontent. He said, you know, I realized I was trying to live today on last year's program. And that was the only thing I heard him say. That's what I had been doing for a year and a half, sort of doing these added girls to myself of having taken these steps and made that amend, and yet I'm still kind of working off of yesterday. That's why the daily maintenance is so important to me. It totally changed how I understand one day at a time. This is the day that counts. This is the day that I have shown up for all of the commitments on my list. And each day always has a number of them to do. And I've done the very best in completed all of those commitments to this moment. And I went on about this journey with another new invigoration. Now, it doesn't mean that my life went skipping down the AA tulip path or anything like that. Life happens, and sometimes it happens big time. Most of the time, I have felt like I have lived like a charmed sobriety. I have had naivety on my side, so I haven't known when a lot of ugly things have happened to me. But on the other hand, when they have had some toughies, I have watched what you did, and I remember being 16 and a half years sober right around there, and my marriage at that time would come to an end, and that was not with my prior approval. My ego was involved, and I was very distraught and so forth, but what I want to share with you is not the source. That's relevant to me, what the source of the pain was. I want to talk to you about what I did with recovery and that pain. Because I know a lot of people have a relationship loss or a family member loss, and I don't know what it's like to be frozen in fear. I've heard about people talk about that. I've never had that experience. But I know what it's like to be a walking zombie consumed with emotional pain top to bottom. And you still got to go out there and live in the world. I can't just stay under the covers for the next 6 months. And I'm at this point in my life when this happens. And at the point in my life, I was about 16 and a half years sober. I was working full time. I was busier in my life than I ever had been. I'm sponsoring the most women I ever had. I am sharing and traveling and going about my business. And I know in some cases I try to out-service the pain, out work with others the pain, out meeting the pain. And I don't know about you, but I couldn't do it. I had to face and feel every ounce of it. I could not hurry it up. I could get distracted by working with you for a period of time, by working the room in my home group, and by listening to everything that was said with intensity to try to get me out of here. But I'd get back in that car and midway, that gabber would start up again. And I know what it's like to be consumed with that day in and day in and day in. And I know also what it's like to be standing up against the wall. And it was the Thanksgiving day, I remember that. And I'm standing up against the wall and all of a sudden just the floodgates broke. And I am just losing it. I'm flat out getting hysterical. And it's just all coming out. All the pain, all the tears, and my legs go wobbly, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting on the floor. And I'm thinking, okay, you know what? You can do this for about another half hour, and then you've got to go get showered up, cleaned up, get dressed, because you have to greet at the meeting tonight. You see, I don't get the night off because I got puffy eyes. I don't get the night off of AA because, well, I just don't feel like smiling tonight and greeting. You know, I just don't. And yet, you see, I also know that it's those type of commitments that I make for future dates that save my life. They save my sanity. And I know that because there have been so many times when I have made an upcoming commitment and that day came and boy, it's a good thing they didn't ask me if I wanted to go tonight because I would probably find some really good excuse, but you see, I know I'm supposed to be at the commitment tonight. It does not matter what my emotional or mental state is at that time. I go. And that's what you taught me about keeping my commitments. And yet I also know that for every dark day I have ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have had a month of sunshine. For every tear I have cried out of self-pity or hurt feelings or misunderstandings or disappointments, I have cried a bucket of joy watching God work in your life and mine. You know, one of the recent things that happened to me that I wanted to share with you was in step three. And with the girls I sponsor, we read out of the big book and I take them through the steps and we read out loud every other paragraph. And there's a sentence in the step three that talks about, you know, first of all, we have to quit playing God. It didn't work. And then it says, next, here and after, in this drama of life, God is going to be our director. And I, not to be blasphemous or anything like that or sacrilegious, but I like to read the big book with the girls in the first person because that way it really feels self-applicable. I can't just say, yeah, you need to let God be your director. So I was reading this and I got to that part and I read it, here and after in this drama of life, God is going to be my director. And just as, you know, emphasized is that all of a sudden that statement, which I have read for 23 years, hit me. because I had been feeling about 4 weeks of some minor self-pity that was just annoying. You know, the kind that won't go away and it's just annoying and it's silly to have, but for some darn reason you're just hanging on to this. And I'm just feeling this, and all of a sudden I read that sentence and it made sense to me for the first time because of the analogy that I used. And I love film. I love every aspect of film, reading and studying it and watching it and everything about it. Anybody who knows me knows that. And all of a sudden I started looking at it like a film. And I thought, you know what? It says here and after in this drama, which most of, I love drama, my life and yours. It's always a comedy too, though, isn't it? You know, and of life, which is my life, God is going to be the director, and the director calls the shots. He says, Deb, okay, here's your mark, here's your script, here's a little bit of what the scene's about. This little fellow's going to come into your life, this will be the interaction, then they're going to exit, okay? Okay. So, action, I'm on my mark, I know my lines, the little fellow comes in, here we go, and he's out the door, and he yells, cut! Here's me. Mr. Director, excuse me, could we, like, maybe do that one again? Could we rehearse some more? I think it would be much better if we added maybe a great love scene, or how about a trip to Paris or something like that? And he's like, no, you've been hired to be the actor. And I love how Bill uses the actor analogies in our book. I love that. And it's like, no, you're hired to be the actor, not write the script, not do the lighting, not set the costumes or the stage, and I'm the director. Because you see, just like in a film, this moment, this frame, this character, you never really know until later on what their purpose was. Aha, you know, and you go, oh, that's why they were introduced at that point. And I'll tell you what a freedom that came over me at that point when all of a sudden I got to look at God directing me like a scene at a time. That I can handle. It was like that became doable. And when they're tough, I mean, I just had a tough past weekend in a situation, and I just thought, you know what, this is a scene at a time, because you've taught me how to act better than I feel, you taught me how to act better than I think, and thank God for that. And I love the direction that He has given in my life and the scenes that He has given me, and I want to thank you for allowing me to be a part of your meeting tonight. Thank you.